So tonight I thought I would teach from Buddha's wisdom teachings, the teachings on the true nature of reality. Which occurred to me as I was sitting in my room this afternoon, it's a slightly risky thing to do. It says in the scriptures that a teacher who teaches on the wisdom teachings on emptiness should be very careful, because it is easy to misunderstand Buddha's wisdom teachings. And so, generally speaking, it's considered appropriate to give those teachings when the disciples have some experience of the Dharma, of Buddha's teachings. So it's risky because I don't know whether you have or not. So if you're here for the first time ever, you've never heard Dharma teaching before, sorry, but this is quite deep end. And if you've heard some Dharma before, then you'd probably be okay. Either way, you'll be okay, actually. This is the most important thing that Buddha taught, because it is the method, when we understand what Buddha explained in the wisdom teachings, is the method to stop all of our suffering permanently. So it's something we definitely need to understand. I mean, there's another reason I was remembering this afternoon, there's another reason why it's risky to teach this. Because there's this story in the scriptures about a particular king, I don't know where he was a king of, but he requested this particular Dharma teacher to come and give teachings. And I think he actually specifically requested wisdom teachings. And in the wisdom teachings, basically what we're told is that everything we know, everything that we understand, everything we believe is wrong. Everything that we think we haven't got. In fact, everything is just and made up. Everything is a projection of our mind. The reality that we think exists doesn't. So this teacher apparently went along and gave very pure teachings to the king, and the king got a little upset, because basically what the teachings were saying was that his palace and his kingdom and all his riches and everything didn't really exist and weren't remotely sources of happiness. And the king was a little bit peeved about that, so he killed the teacher, which is poor form in my opinion, but anyway. But he killed the teacher. And then sadly, a little while later, or sometime later, he received more teachings, and this, and another teacher told him the same thing, and he realised the error of his ways. But by then it was already a bit late because he'd knocked off the teacher. So, yeah, sometimes there's great danger in teaching these teachings if someone misunderstands. So all I can say about that is if you misunderstand, just don't kill me. It's not good for you. It's a bad karma. So in the King of Concentration Sutra, Buddha said, in a dream, a girl meets a boy and discovers that he is dying. She is pleased to meet him, but sad to know that he is dying. You should know that all phenomena are like this. So in the dream, a girl meets a boy. You have to read between the lines here, but in the dream, the girl meets a boy and she develops some attachment to him. Yeah, quite likes him. So she develops some attachment to him because she doesn't realise that she's dreaming. She doesn't realise that he's just a projection of her dreaming mind. In the dream, she discovers that he's dying and she's sad. She has an experience of sadness to know that he is dying because she doesn't realise that she's dreaming. She doesn't realise the boy is just a projection of her dreaming mind, and therefore there's nothing to be sad about because he's not really going anywhere because he wasn't really there to begin with. Because she doesn't realise she's dreaming, she doesn't realise those things. Buddha said we should know that all phenomena are like this. Everything we experience is like what we experience in a dream. And we think everything is very real. and solid and fixed and independently existing, when in reality, everything's just a projection of our mind, in exactly the same way that last night's dream was just a projection of our mind. So it's important for us to understand this teaching, to understand that everything is a projection of our mind, because we presently believe something different, and what we believe is the source of all of our suffering and problems. Like all of our, every part of our suffering, every kind of suffering we experience. We experience because we have a particular view. We hold tightly to a particular view of reality, and that view is wrong. So the view of reality that we hold is that things exist independently. Things exist from their side. Like, we believe what our senses tell us. You know, it seems to our senses, doesn't it, that there is a world out there, like waiting for us to experience it. Like you came here tonight expecting this temple to be here. Like there's this external reality that is this temple, and you just have to walk in it. Now that view, which we can call self-grasping, is a mistaken view. Because nothing exists as an independent entity. Nothing exists separate from mind. Buddha said, mind is the creator of all things. There is no creator other than mind. Everything that we experience is a projection of our mind. If our mind is projecting correctly, then what we experience will be good. But if our mind is projecting incorrectly, which it is all the time, then we have problems. It's a bit of a sad state of affairs for us, really, but yeah. So we hold this particular view that ourselves, other people, the objects around us, even the sensations and feelings we experience, everything is an independently existing experience or reality. Like it's like we believe there is an objective truth. You know, we believe that, don't we? It's the reason we have arguments with people, isn't it? Because we think we know the truth, and they've got it wrong. We think there really is a truth. Yeah? If you ever have to mediate a conflict with two people, you know, I have to do this sometimes in Dharma centres. People come to me and they explain their side of the story, and they're absolutely convinced that they have the objective truth. It is like that. They are like, this person is like that, and this situation is like this. This is what actually happened. Objectively. And someone else will come in and tell the same situation completely differently, and they've got the objective truth. We have this experience all the time, don't we? And the reality is there is no objective truth, and yet we believe so strongly, we grasp so strongly, hold so tightly to that being the case. That's completely wrong, and it's the basis of all of our suffering. You know, we believe that the things around us, and in fact we ourselves, exist independently, separately from our mind. And that's the source of all of our problems. You know, we observe this body and mind, and we think I. But it seems to us like there is just an I existing, that like there is a self here that is just me. It just exists, self. And because of that, we make a distinction between self and other. There's self here, it really exists independently, and everything, all the rest is other. And we create this gap between self and other. And then sadly, we go even further and we conclude that the self that we are grasping at, we're believing to exist inherently, we believe that self to be supremely precious, supremely important. We refer to this as the mind of self-cherishing. We regard ourselves as more important than others. The person we're most interested in is me. Yeah, all the time, the person we're most concerned about is ourselves. And on the basis of that, then we develop other delusions or negative states of mind. the things that make this I that I believe to exist independently, the things that make it feel good, that are pleasant to it, we develop attachment for. And the things that we perceive make it feel bad or unpleasant to it, we develop aversion for. Now, Buddha referred to these three minds as the three poisons, didn't he? The three poisons: anger, attachment, and ignorance. The poisons because they cause all of our suffering in our mind. Because out of these negative states of mind, out of this ignorance grasping at independently existent things, we then develop these other negative minds of attachment and aversion. And on the basis of these three minds, we engage in actions that harm others. Now, out of attachment, we may want something, maybe that belongs to someone else. But with a strong mind of attachment, we'll take it, we'll try to take it. And so we accumulate negative karma. Out of a mind of aversion or dislike for someone else, we regard someone or something as a problem, as a source of our suffering. And we want to push it away, and we will harm it to get rid of it. And so we'll accumulate negative karma. So if you think about it, all of our suffering we can track back to this grasping mind, to this belief in an independent reality. Any suffering we have, we know, don't we? Any suffering that we have in this life is arising due to our karma. We can't experience the suffering unless we have some karma to experience that. Yeah? All karma comes out of negative intention, doesn't it? So it's motivated by ignorance, attachment and aversion. Attachment and aversion themselves coming from this mind of ignorance. So we all hold this view. It's our most deeply held, deeply ingrained view that myself, other people, all things around me have an independent existence. It's the most deeply held view. We're so familiar with it, though, it's almost impossible for us to spot it. It's so part of our usual way of thinking. We just can't see it. It's like it's natural, like breathing for us. And we look around us and it seems to us like objects exist outside of us, completely separate from us, doesn't it? Like you look around this room, it seems like everything here just exists completely independently of our mind. We don't think for one moment that we created this reality, do we? We don't think that. We think it's out there existing independently. That view is wrong. And it's causing us constant pain and suffering. In fact, it is the very mind that perpetuates the cycle of suffering existence, or samsara. It's that mind, that belief in an independent reality that causes the kind of wheel of samsara to keep turning. And lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, we're stuck in this cycle of suffering because we keep engaging in negative actions. And we keep engaging in negative actions because we've got this wrong view, deeply held wrong view. So generally, when we start to tackle this view that there is an independent reality, then there are a couple of ways to start to kind of tackle this mind or loosen this mind up. You know, literally, like it's referred to as self-grasping. There's a tight mind, it's a grasping mind. It's holding on to there being this fixed, independent reality. It's a very, very tight mind. It's not relaxed mind at all. It's no wonder we're so tense all the time because we're constantly grasping at this independent existence out there. It feels to us like, doesn't it, like there's a world out there that determines how we should feel. Certain things seem to us to be just from their side good, don't they? And there are other things that just seem to us from their side to be bad. It's almost like if we assent to this view that there is an independent reality out there, we're assenting to the view that stuff out there determines how I feel. It's ridiculous, really. How can external stuff, people and places and things, external objects, how can they produce an internal feeling? And yet we believe that very strongly. We believe strongly there are certain things that just are sources of happiness, and there are other things that are sources of suffering. You can know that we hold tightly to this view because we're shocked, aren't we, when someone disagrees with us. When we think something is a true source of happiness and someone else says, I don't like it, we're shocked. It's a clear indication, isn't it, that we're grasping at a particular idea, a particular reality being a certain way. Otherwise we wouldn't be surprised by that. Now, I'm constantly surprised by the fact that some people like Brussels sprouts. It's a constant source of fascination to me. But I wouldn't have that mind if I didn't have grasping. From my side, Brussels sprouts look to be inherently bad. They're foul, aren't they, don't you think? I'll do a little survey later. I just think they're revolting. You know, from my side, from my view, there's an objective reality. Brussels sprouts are disgusting. There are other people who think, oddly, clearly wrong, that Brussels sprouts are good. Even if people go on to me about, I'm just cooking them wrong, they tell me. Everyone's always giving me this advice about how to cook them so I like them. So I'm not interested. They're gross. But it's because we believe in this objective, independent reality that we are surprised when someone disagrees with our view. We're always surprised, aren't we? Like someone else has got a different take on things. We think, how's that possible? Because there is, it is like this. It really is like this. So Buddha said that what we need to do to help us to realise the true nature of things, which is that things are actually a projection of our mind. We make it up. We make the whole thing up. This whole reality, we make it up. He said the way to prove that that's true is that we need to check how it is the case that both phenomena, all external phenomena, all phenomena, and ourselves, this person, lack inherent or true existence. They lack independent existence. So he said we need to check through analytical investigation. We need to check in meditation to prove to ourselves, to convince ourselves that although I believe very strongly certain things to exist inherently, when I actually look for those things, I can't find them. Now, if something existed inherently, independently of all other things, then I have to be able to find it, don't I? Yeah. That's the kind of definition of something. If something exists, we've got to be able to find it, don't we? Otherwise, you can't say it exists. So if something exists independently, then I have to be able to find it. So it is suggested to us, and Buddha suggests to us, that we use our ability to analyse, to investigate, and we look for objects. If an object that we believe to exist independently actually exists, then I must be able to find that object by isolating it from everything else around it. I must be able to find that object without finding anything that is not that object. Then I found an independently existing object. To take as a kind of mundane example, your car, for example, if you've got one. So I don't know, probably quite a few. There's a lot of cars outside, I noticed, when we came in tonight. So I'm assuming quite a few people came here in a car. So if we just look on a conventional level for our car, you go outside and you think, right, where's my car? And you look in the place where you remember that you parked it, and you see your car, don't you? At a conventional level, that's true. You go outside, you find your car. You've got this image in your mind of what your car looks like. Go outside and you find it, hopefully, unless someone's knocked it off. I shouldn't ever say that, should I? Because if someone come outside and their car will be stolen, it'll be my fault. It won't be, actually, but you know. But conventionally, we think, okay, I'm going to go find my car. And we find it. If you've got some vague memory of where you put it, then chances are you can find it. Yeah? But if you look for something that is actually an independently existing car, a car that is existing from its own side, independent of all other things. Because that's how we believe it exists, don't we? We believe there is just a car there. And we don't think we created it in any way. We don't think our mind brought it into existence. It's just an independently existing car. If I go and look for that car, this independently existing car, can you find it? So imagine we'll all go outside, imagine, and stand by someone's car, stand by Norgin's car, and we'll say, where's the car? And Norgin will go, well, it's there. And she'll point. But what will she point at? She might point at the door, or the wheel, or the window, or the roof, or the bonnet, or something. But is the door the car? Or is the window the car? Is the bonnet the car? Is the wheels the car? Aren't all those things just parts of the car? They're not actually the car themselves, are they? So if I go outside and I look for this thing that is ultimately, really, independently a car, can I find one? All I can find, all I can point to, are parts of this thing that I call car. But can't actually point to something that is actually a car, can I? Because most we wouldn't agree, would we, that the parts of a car are a car itself, would we? You know, you don't. If I just gave you a door, said there's your car, you probably wouldn't be all right with that, would you? Like I have all these images of those movies where someone's car gets stolen, they get back a stripped car, and they've just got the metal frame bit called, and a couple of seats or something, and nothing else left. And they're not happy, are they? Because it's not their car. If you went outside and all that was left was a door and a wheel and a window, you wouldn't think, there's my car, would you? You think something else entirely differently. Probably something I can't say while I'm sitting up here. You wouldn't think that's your car, would you? It's just parts of the car. It's not actually the car. I mean, if it was true that the door was the car and the wheel was the car and the window was the car and the bonnet was the car, that would mean I had lots of cars, wouldn't it? I had loads and loads of cars. So maybe we think, well, you know, what you do is you get a whole group of things like the bonnet and the wheel and the doors and the windows and the stuff, motor, things like that. You lump them all together and then you have a car. But that's just a collection of parts, isn't it? That's just a collection of things that are not cars. Like if the door isn't the car and the wheel isn't the car and the window isn't the car and the boot and the bonnet and all those other bits, they aren't the car. They're a whole pile of things that are non-cars. How can I put them together and say, car? All I've actually got is a collection of non-car. Haven't I? So where really is the car? Like if the car truly exists from its own side as an independent entity, I have to be able to point to the car without pointing at anything else. Can you do that? You can't, can you? You can't point to the car without something else appearing. It's true that if you can find this thing that is the car without finding anything that is not the car, then it stands to reason that I could take away all the parts of the car, because I've already decided they're not the car. I could take away all of those and I'd be left with a car. It's true, isn't it? That's how logic follows, isn't it? If all those parts are not the car, well, take them all away and I've still got a car. You'd have to have quite a good imagination, wouldn't you? It doesn't work, does it? So you might think, well, yeah, but what's the point? Reasonable question. What's the point? We grasp at, hold tightly to this idea that there is a car, don't we? An independently existing car. And if someone crashes into my car or steals my car, we feel upset, don't we? Because we believe it really exists. We're like the girl in the dream, believing the boy really exists as an independent reality, and so we get upset when separated from it. something bad happens to our car, my car, then we're bothered by it because we believe it really exists. If we thought, actually, it's just a dream, wasn't there in the first place, wouldn't be worried, would we? Now, we have this problem in our mind in relation to everything, absolutely everything. Yeah. They might think it's kind of, you know, mundane when you think about it in terms of the things around you, like your car and the microphone and your shoes that you left outside and various things like that. It seems kind of mundane. But one of the things that we grasp at really, really strongly, the thing that we most strongly grasp at is I, isn't it? We have this strong sense all the time of an independently existing I. Like if I ask any one of you, where are you? You go, I'm here. We have a strong sense, don't you? You won't go, you're here. You know what I mean. Like we have a strong sense, don't we? Of like an I or self. Yeah? Which is why we get so upset when we believe that our I or self has been wounded or harmed or gets sick or any of these things. Because we grasp so strongly, so tightly at this sense of I. We feel pain whenever that I is harmed in any way. Yeah. But the funny thing is that I doesn't exist either. You know, just like the car is a projection of my mind, I group together a whole pile of stuff and I call it car. I impute, I name it, I call it car, and that's a reasonable thing to do. You've got a certain collection of things, you can put them together, you can call them a car, and if that's all I did, it would be fine, but it isn't. What we do is we believe it really exists. We don't believe we brought it into existence, we believe it actually is there. When in reality, all that's happened is we've imputed it, we've made it up, we've named it, and so it's come into existence. And we do exactly the same thing with this I or self. If you go looking for this thing that is an independently existing self or I, you can't find one. And yet all the time, every moment of every day, we are so concerned about this I, aren't we? Constantly concerned about whether it's comfortable, whether it's happy, all these things, all day, every day, checking, always. How is my I now? Yeah. Am I happy with this? Am I comfortable with that? Am I bored? Is she nuts? What's this all about? How is this for me? We're checking all the time, aren't we? But this I, it's a fabrication. We've made it up. It doesn't even exist. It yawns loudly, though. If you go looking for an independently existing I, and that's what we believe exists, we believe that there is an I, an independently existing I that exists strongly. If you go looking for it, you can't actually find it. It's like the car. All you'll actually find is an absence. Yeah. Like we can think, okay, well, where if there was an I, if there was a self, a real I, a real self, if there really was one, where would it be? It would either be this body, or the mind, or the collection of the body and the mind, or something entirely different. There's only four possibilities, isn't there? An I. It's either a body, it's a mind, it's a collection of body and mind, or it's something completely different. If it isn't in any of those things, then it doesn't exist. If it exists, I have to be able to find it without finding anything that's not it. Yeah? So if the I, start with the body. If this I, like if you bring to mind a strong sense of I, like for example when you're really embarrassed. You know, like when you do something really stupid, you get really embarrassed. You have a strong sense of I, don't you? Or like if you're very scared, you know, if you get threatened, for example, You have a strong, strong sense of I. Yeah? And that I, when it appears to you, it appears, doesn't it, to be very real and solid. Yeah? Or even if you just say your name to yourself, you're like, where's Nampa? Nampa's there. There's an immediate sense of an I. There is this person, this being, that is Nampa. When you say your name to yourself, you have the same effect. There's this sense of this independently existing I. It really feels like it doesn't depend on anything else, doesn't it? It just appears there instantly, I. Now, if that I really exists, I have to be able to find it. So where is it? So is my I, you have to ask yourself these questions, is my I my body? Like, do you think I'm a body? Do you think that? I don't think you do you? If I am just body, there's no point in saying my body, because they're the same thing. Possessor and possessed, same thing. No, there's no sense in saying my body, and yet we talk about my body as if there is an I that possesses it, don't we? There's some being that owns this body. So it indicates that we don't think our I and our body are the same thing. If our I and our body are the same thing, it means rebirth isn't possible. Because when your body dies, I is over. Finished. End of story. No rebirth. You know, our sense of I is capable of many, many, many things, isn't it? Like, I can think certain things. I can go and do certain things. I can have a mind of faith. I can think about the wisdom teachings. Our I can do many things. So if our I and our body are the same thing, that means that my body can do those things as well. So my body can analyse the ultimate nature of reality. Like, my big toe can think. It's like saying the same thing, isn't it? My big toe can't think. It's asleep now. But it's like, it's not thinking. So our eye's not our body, is it? You don't just think you're a body, do you? It'd be a bit strange if you did, I think. We don't think, when we think I, we don't think I'm just a body. We don't think that. So maybe think, well, maybe I is a mind. Maybe I is mind. I am a mind. Do you think that? If you were a mind and you didn't have a body, would you still think you're an I? You wouldn't, would you? You've got to have somewhere to put your mind, for starters. You've got somewhere to carry it around in. So we don't think we are just a mind, do we? If I and mind are the same thing, then there's no sense in saying my mind. Because again, possessor and possessed are the same thing. But we say that, don't we? We say in my mind or to my mind. To my mind, it's like this. We say that, don't we? That indicates that we think there is an I that possesses a mind. So where's this I that's possessing this mind? Mysterious creature, can't find it. We have lots of different minds, don't we? We have happy minds, we have miserable minds, we have bored minds, we have interested minds, we have analytical minds, we have sense awareness, we have all sorts of minds, don't we? That would mean I've got lots of eyes, wouldn't it? If my eye is my mind, then every different mind is another eye. That means I've got loads of them. How many eyes have you got? You've only got one, haven't you? When you have a sense of I, don't you just have a sense of having one I? There is this one I or self that is me. Huh? We don't think we've got lots. So the fallback that we all come to, of course, is the idea that, well, actually, what I am is a collection of body and mind. It's obvious, isn't it? So we think. I must be a collection of body and mind. So we've already decided that body is not I, and mind is not I, So how can I lump together a whole lot of stuff that are not eyes and call it eye? I mean, the only way I can do that, actually, is by imputation, is by conceptual mind thinking that collection of things is an eye. But that just means that my mind's made that up. It's just my mind's labelled it, doesn't it? Isn't it? That's all that's happening. My mind's making that up. But you can't have a collection of non-eyes and then call them eye, because they're just a collection of non-eyes. That's the same as saying I've got a collection of cows and I'll call it sheep. It's exactly the same argument, isn't it? I've got a collection, a whole lot of stuff that are not sheep, but because I've got lots of them, I'll call them sheep. That's daft, isn't it? No one would buy that. It's exactly the same. So we can't say this collection of non-eyes, body bits and mind, that can't be an eye. It's just a collection of non-eyes, just a collection of body and mind, that's all. It's not an eye. So the only possibility that remains is that my eye is something other than, something separate from my body and mind. That's the only other possibility that remains. So if that's the case, then I should be able to take away everything that is not I, and I will remain. So I can take away my body. Imagine I just take it away, bit by bit if you like. Imagine that you just take away this body and then take away this mind, and what's left? There's nothing there, is there? There's nothing left. There is an absence. There is an emptiness. Where previously there was this sense of, strongly held sense of I, now there is just an absence of I. That is what Buddha referred to as ultimate truth. It is an absence, a lack of inherent existence. Where previously I thought there were things, when I check with an analytical mind, when I check with a wisdom mind, those things aren't there. And all I can actually find is an absence. All I can find is a lack. So if I can't find this I, who is it that's getting attached to things? And who is it that gets upset when things go wrong? Or who is it that gets angry? Who is it that gets scared? Who is it that feels limited? Who is it that feels proud? Like who is all that stuff happening to? If I can't find this I, who is it that's having all those experiences? Nothing there. There's just an absence. There's no one having all those experiences. So they're not really happening, are they? They're just a projection of mind. That's all. Now, the one place that we go wrong with Buddha's wisdom teaching is that we think Buddha is saying that nothing exists. That's wrong. Buddha is saying things don't exist independently or inherently in the way that we believe them to exist. That doesn't mean that they don't exist at all. We can say that they exist by convention or they exist as mere name, but that's all. Like, it's quite appropriate to label this body and mind here Nampa. It's an appropriate label given to me by my abbot. It's an appropriate label. You can use it to refer to me and I'll answer back. It's an appropriate label, but that's all. There isn't actually anything here that really is independently Nampa. If you really go looking for me, you can't find me. But it doesn't mean there is nothing here at all. Because otherwise, who's talking to you? What are you listening to? So there's something here, isn't there? Like from a conventional point of view, we can say, yeah, there is this person called Nampa, from a conventional point of view. But it's not the independently existent person that we think is there. And the same applies to absolutely everything, ourself, all other people, all phenomena, everything around us. Conventionally, we can label things, we can use them. We label them according to their function. So we can do that, that's fine, conventionally. And if we only ever did that, it would be all right. We wouldn't have any problems. But we do have problems because we believe that there is something behind the label. We believe that there is something existing truly behind the label. And we grasp at that, and then we get all of our suffering as a consequence. The Buddha said that all phenomena are like dreams. So one way to help us to kind of move our mind to this idea a bit, because it's kind of strange when we think about this from an analytical point of view, I know. But one way to move our mind to it is just to think about how things appear to us in a dream. And they appear to be completely real, don't they? Things in dreams seem absolutely real. And the only time we figure out that they're not real is when we wake up. We wake up for a dream and we think, oh, that was just a dream. And we understand that what appeared to us was just a projection of mind. It was just a projection of our dreaming mind. So Buddha said, this reality, in inverted commas, is just like that. It's just like a projection, but to a waking mind. You know, it's really helpful to contemplate the analogy of a dream. You know, in a dream, it really does feel to us, doesn't it, that everything that we experience is completely real, doesn't it? Like in dreams, although dreams have some slightly different rules about them, don't they? Some odd stuff goes on in dreams from time to time, doesn't it? You know, that we just accept as like, oh yeah, that's just dream stuff. You know, strange things can happen in dreams. But everything seems to us to be completely real. Like in a dream, you can reach out and touch something and it feels solid, feels real. You can touch another person can touch you and it feels real. You can taste things in your dreams, you can hear things in your dreams. It all seems completely real. And yet it's just an appearance to mind. It's an appearance to a dreaming mind. You know, in your dream, if something scary chases after you, like some big monster appears and chases you, what do? Yeah, you run. Because in your dream, you believe it's real. If you didn't believe it was real, you'd probably turn around and do something different. But because you believe it's real, we take off, don't we? Leg it. Because we believe it's real. Buddha said there's no difference between this waking world and our dream. We just believe this is real. We're just assenting to an appearance. There is an appearance. Yeah? There is an appearance and we assent to it. We believe it, just like we believed last night's dream. Yeah? You know, Buddha means awakened one, doesn't it? Yeah? It means they've woken up from the sleep of their ignorance. This analogy often used, like we're like people asleep. It's like there's this dream happening and we're believing it. When we become enlightened, we wake up, we go, oh, that was just a dream. And we will be, for the first time ever, totally relieved and relaxed. So you think, oh, I get it. I was making that up. None of that was real. You know, you have that experience. If you've had a bad dream and you wake up from the dream, you think, oh, thank goodness. That wasn't real. Like last night I had this dream that this monk that I know was giving this teaching really badly and I had to sit through it. It was going on and on and on. And it was really boring. I'm like, oh, he's going to stop soon. And I was going, oh, it's terrible. And I remember waking up thinking, oh, thank goodness. I wasn't real. Because I thought he'd completely lost the plot. It's terrible. I was so relieved. Oh, it's just a dream. We have that experience, don't we? You have a bad dream. Something scares you in a dream or something. You wake up and think, oh, I just made that up. snow wasn't real. We relax. It's going to be like that when we realize the ultimate nature of reality, when we realize things do not exist independently, separately from my mind. They exist as projections of my mind. In the same way that in my dream, I project a dream world. And we do that. We project a whole world in our dreams, don't we? Yeah. This is a whole set of characters and different scenarios and all sorts of stuff. It's as complex as this world that we're experiencing now, isn't it? No different. It's just that one is an appearance, a projection of the waking mind, and one is an appearance or projection of the dream mind. Now, the dream mind ends when we wake up. When the dream awareness or the dream mind ends, everything that is appearing to that mind vanishes, doesn't it? You don't wake up and think, oh, where's that person? You know, if you're dreaming about an elephant, you don't wake up and think, oh, where's the elephant? Probably don't. Or after you've looked the first couple of times, you conclude there is no elephant, don't you? You look under your bed and stuff like that. You know, there's no elephant, I just dreamt it. And you check. You know, like, and the reality, you know, at the end of this life, the projections that we are making now cease, don't they? Because the minds of this life cease. It's just like waking up. Sadly, we're going to probably wake up to something as bad as this, but anyway, that's another story. But everything of this world as we know it now ceases to be because this mind that is experiencing it ceases and a different mind develops and a different mind arises. But the whole thing is just a projection of our mind. So Buddha suggested that if we really want to understand these wisdom teachings, we want to understand the true nature of reality, that everything is projection of mind, nothing is an independently existing. Nothing exists from its own side. If we really want to understand that, then we need to do some analysis. We need to meditate on this many, many, many times. Think about it. You know, using an example like ourself or I. You know, it's powerful to use that example because it's the thing we most grasp at. So we use an example like that. We meditate on over and over and over again over many years. It's not quick. You know, we get some intellectual understanding very quickly, probably. But to understand deeply, to have realization, takes a long time. So we do this in meditation. We contemplate things like dreams as an analogy. You know, think about how it's true. You know, you can think about this every night as you go to sleep. I'm going to create this whole other world in my dreams, and in the morning it will cease to exist because the dream mind will end. So you can think about how your mind is producing these realities every night or whenever you go to sleep. But it's producing these realities. So we can think about the dream analogy. And then also what we can do in our day-to-day life is just try to... Buddha said you can think two things. One is you can think everything is like an illusion or everything is like a dream. Now, either one of these things. In our day-to-day life, we try to hold this view. Everything I'm experiencing is like an illusion or like a dream. It appears that there is this independent, solid, fixed reality out there. It's an illusion. Yeah? So we just try not to assent to that appearance. Yeah? I used to have a post-it note on my wall that said, disbelieve that it's real. Just disbelieve it. You know, our senses will tell us that there is this independent reality out there, existing separately. Disbelieve it. Just don't believe it. Yeah? It appears that way to our mind. But we need to educate our mind to understand differently. It's not actually how things exist. So then if you want to understand these teachings more, then some meditation to contemplate, analyse various objects, yourself, other things around you, contemplate things like dreams, but then also, most importantly, in your day-to-day life, just start to question, you know. Start to question. Everything that is appearing to me, just try to remember, it's like a dream or like an illusion. Yeah. Which doesn't mean you won't respond to things, because in a dream you still respond to things, don't you? Like if something chases you in your dream, you still run away if it's going to hurt you. So the same is true in your waking life. You think to yourself, this is a dream, this is like an illusion. But it doesn't mean you ignore things. You don't step out into the traffic thinking, oh, we'll see how much of a dream this is. Don't do that, because it'll hurt. You get squished. Buddha's not saying that nothing exists, remember? The truck coming quickly towards you exists in a conventional sense, and it will hurt your conventional body. I'm not suggesting nothing exists, but it doesn't exist in the way that we think it does. And we need to loosen up. We need to change the way that we think things exist, because that's the basis of all our suffering and problems. So anyway, you can have a bit of a play with this. I'm trying to remember everything's just like a dream, like an illusion. Let's see what happens. Okay, I should probably stop talking because it's a long time to be talking. Can do.
How do we stop the mind creating these realities? Because whether I'm in dream or in real reality, which I think is real today, here maybe, on my daily life, I suffer suffering. To me, it doesn't matter whether it affects me dependently or independently, it makes me suffering. And if this should help me, that I think it's illusion. I still suffer even in the dream if something chases me.
Yeah.
So, and it's illusion and it's dependent and not independent, but it doesn't matter to me. I don't want the suffering, so how do I stop the mind creating this reality?
Yeah. To begin with, until we actually remove this level of ignorance from our mind completely, you can't stop it doing this. The mind will continue to do this for a long time. Yeah. But what we need to do is just slowly over time keep working with these meditations, really challenging. Well, if it exists, then I must be able to find it. So we can start to train with things like our experiences of suffering. You know, even my experience of suffering, can I find it? Can I find this thing that is independently the experience of suffering? You know, like a physical pain, for example. Can I find this thing that is actually the pain? Is there an I? Can I find this I that is experiencing the pain? And as soon as we start to loosen up our grasping at the I or the pain or the problem or whatever it is, whatever the suffering is, then immediately the suffering reduces. Now, it won't go away completely to begin with. It's not going to take it away straight away. I mean, this is a slow process to train the wisdom teachings. But just whatever basic understanding that we have, if we apply it now, there will be reduction in suffering. Yeah? Just even the thought, this is just a dream. It isn't really real. Yeah? Even that will loosen the mind up a little bit so that our suffering reduces. Because part of the problem when we suffer now is that we make our suffering worse because of the grasping in our mind. Because of the tightness in our mind, we make it so much worse for ourselves. So if we just reduce that a little bit, naturally suffering reduces. So there isn't a quick quick way with this. We have to train in it over a long period of time and just keep bringing that understanding that we have, that this is a projection of my mind. It doesn't really exist independently. We keep bringing that awareness in. Try to remember that, it's a dream. It's a projection of my mind. Yeah? It's like sometimes, it's a bad dream, but it's just a dream. We just keep bringing that awareness in, and over time that loosens the mind up a bit. It's not quick. It's not quick. You'll still experience some suffering for a while. And the reality is, while we're in samsara, we will continue to experience some suffering. It's inevitable. It's an inevitable part of samsara. Does that help?
Okay. Well, if I don't want to go because it's suffering, and I want to stay at home or go swimming, then I'm going, okay, this is illusion, I am making this up, but
yeah.
It doesn't give me the opportunity not to go to work.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That anyway. So
yep.
Whether that work exists,
yeah,
dependently or independently, it is still making me the suffering.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not making you the suffering. Work isn't making you the suffering. Our mind is making us the suffering. So, yeah, and I mean, we have to keep that. We need to come to what's called middle way. There's an extreme at the moment that we're in where we grasp at an independent reality, and what the tendency that then happens in our mind when we start to loosen that up often is that we go the opposite extreme, which is like, oh well, nothing exists, and therefore I don't want to go to work because it's boring, I don't like it, and I'm not going to do all these other things, and blah, you know, and we fall into another extreme of nothingness. And to begin with, that's okay, you know, as long as you don't get sacked. But it's like okay to begin with, but then you've got to come back to the middle somewhere. You know, but I mean, it's really important then to remember whatever suffering I'm experiencing, is a projection of my mind. So it's not that work or any external condition is causing my suffering. It isn't. It's my reaction to it. It's my mind in relation to that. That's the cause of the suffering. So sorry, you're going to have to go to work.
I would like to know if everything mind, everything is the mind, everything is the projection, that is no God. Millions of people worship Lord Buddha. Millions of people worship Lord Krishna, Jesus Christ, thousands of saints, arahants, and all that. So I cannot understand if there is no individuality. We seem to be all worshipping non-existent people. Everything is just a dream. Everything just is our projection. Where do we stand then?
Yeah, yeah, you're right though. Even Buddha is a projection of the mind. Even this teaching on emptiness, the ultimate nature of reality, is also a projection of the mind. Nothing exists. But from a conventional point of view, we can say, Buddha existed, Buddha exists, Buddha taught, all those other teachers also taught. People, from a conventional point of view, we can say all those things exist. In exactly the same way that you can say from a conventional point of view, I'm here now talking to you. But it's not in the... Our mind is thinking that there is this independent reality, and that's not true. There is, you know, there's a person here talking because we label it person. Or we label it Nampa, or we label it teacher, or we label whatever. But it's not existing independently from its own side. So we have to, again, it's about finding the middle way. You know, at the moment we're in this extreme of grasping things to be inherently existent. Buddha is not saying nothing exists. He's just saying it doesn't exist in the way that it appears to us at the moment. So he's not saying that those teachers don't exist. He's not saying that, you know, that there aren't people for us to follow and so on. But he's saying that things don't exist in the way they appear. They appear to exist as independent, inherent realities, and that's not true. But they do exist from a conventional point of view. They exist as mere name or mere imputation. So I can impute Buddha. It's correct to do so. But it doesn't mean that Buddha exists as an independent reality or an independent being. I can't really see you out there. Just shout if you...
Sister, in Mahayana Buddhism and Vajrayana Buddhism, there's this emphasis on emptiness, you know, no self, nothing exists, right? You know, like, yeah. So there's, okay, on the other hand, in Buddhism, we have previous lives. We have a previous karma.
Mm.
So yep. To the extent, surely there's some underlying, isn't it? Like a, how do you say, consciousness? We have this previous thing. You see what I mean? If nothing exists by itself, how about previous, we have previous lives or you know, previous karma or this thing?
Yeah, yeah. All those things exist, but again, they exist conventionally. They don't exist from their own side. And in fact, when we really understand the wisdom teachings, they fit perfectly with karma. Because karma is just a law of cause and effect, isn't it? If I do certain actions, certain results will come. That indicates that things are dependently related. Yeah. So if I want to produce a certain reality, it depends upon other things. It cannot therefore be an independent reality. It's not possible. So in fact, when we really get this, the wisdom teachings and karma are like, it's almost like they're almost the same thing. Because karma is talking about a dependent relationship, and the wisdom teachings are saying the same thing. Everything exists as a dependent arising. Everything exists dependent on mind as one level of dependence. There are a number of levels of dependence, but one of the ways that things exist is dependent on mind, and that's not inconsistent with teachings on karma.
Like emptiness, I do understand too, but surely there's some underlying reason.
Find it.
It's just as simple as that. There's previous life, there's.
I know. It seems like there should be, but can you find it? I mean, that's the ultimate test, isn't it? If something exists, I have to be able to find it. So if there is something that's underlying, can I find it? Now, we agree, in Mahayana Buddhism, we agree as well, that there is a mind, there is mind that travels from one life to the next. Yeah? But it's just a moment of mind, and you cannot say it's independently existing. Yeah? It also is, it's mind that's a projection of mind. That's a bit much, isn't it? This hour on a Friday night, but yeah. But yeah, even that, I mean, it's true, there is something that moves from one life to the next, but it's not an inherently existing thing. It is also projection of mind.
I guess for myself, I always thought there's an under, I've asked before, all this information, but I think there's some underlying, that's only me.
That's what most people believe. Like, it's what we tend to believe. There is this sense, and this is this thing. We have this strong, strong grasping at I or self, and we believe there is something here that is I or self, and it's going to travel to the next life. That's like, it's an example of this really strongly grasping mind, because we do believe there is something there, independently, inherently, that is going to travel from one life to the next. And Buddha's saying no. You just have to think about it for a long time, and then it gets absolutely crystal clear. Promise. Yeah, it does. It does, because that's what I was saying in the beginning. Like the thing that we grasp at most strongly is a sense of I. The idea that that isn't there rocks our world. You know, it's like, what? What do you mean I'm not here? And there's nothing that is independently me that's going to my next life. That's just too much. It's interesting actually, because it said that when we have a realization of the lack of an inherently existent I, one of two things happen. We either get really, really scared because we think, oh my God, I don't exist. Or we think, oh, thank goodness for that, what a relief. It's like, either one's good apparently, but you know, like, I don't know, I haven't got there. But either way, it's shocking to us because we grasp so strongly at this sense of this independently existent I. So yeah, when we realise it's not there, it's a bit of a surprise. Good. Absolutely. We are creating our entire reality. No one else to blame. Yep. Yeah, if we get this, you can't avoid a profound sense of responsibility, you're right. Yep. Well done.